It is a great pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Boston. Gary Mishuris is the managing partner of Silver Ring Value Partners, an investment firm with a concentrated long-term value approach. Before founding the firm in 2016, Gary was a managing director at Manulife Asset Management since 2011, where he was the lead portfolio manager of the U.S.-focused value strategy. Earlier in his career, Gary worked as a research associate at Fidelity and vice president at Evergreen Investments, later part of Wells Capital. Gary holds degrees in computer science and economics from MIT. Gary shared his wisdom and ideas with our members in the past, and we are very grateful he has chosen this opportunity to be with us again. So on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome to you, Gary. The floor is yours. Please go ahead.
Great, John, and thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be part of this wonderful community that you've created and you've built, and I look forward to continuing to be part of it. So today, basically, I'll start with a very brief overview of the firm. You can certainly follow up if you have any questions, but mainly I'm going to focus on the idea, which will be Allergan, and the ticker is AGN. Briefly about Silver Ring Value Partners, it's a concentrated long-term value partnership, and really the focus is on long-term safe compounding of capital with an emphasis on microeconomic analysis. So the idea being, I don't have very much insight into macroeconomic events or timing, and I try to find situations where it is the micro, whether it's industry structural analysis or the competitive advantage of the company or its growth prospects that are being misunderstood. Basically, I think that Allergan is indeed such a case. You can see here the approach they use is to come up with a range of intrinsic value estimates. And I think I shared this with you, John, before. I always think of the idea of the price asking the question. And to me, what that means is that, at one price, the things you have to know for something to be a good investment is very different from what those things might be at a very different price. And here I present this visually, and we basically have three components of value. And so Allergan is a pharmaceutical company. It has a drug called Botox, which is used for both aesthetic and therapeutic reasons. It also has a number of other medical aesthetics drugs, such as fillers that help remove lines from the face and a few other things. And these drugs really are much more similar to luxury goods in their underlying economic characteristics than they are to your typical drug, which has a limited patent life and then expires and that revenue stream goes away. So the first two bars you see in terms of the components of value for each scenario, it's the blue bar is Botox and the orange bar is medical aesthetics. The next component of value is all the other medications, and they have a slew of all these medications. We won't talk about them too much, primarily because they're not a huge component of value, and secondarily because they're much more typical where they have a finite life. We more or less know when the patent will expire, and we have a pretty decent idea what that cash flow stream looks like. And the third and final piece of value is the R&D pipeline. So a company like this invests money today, and it's going to see a return, or maybe it will, maybe it won't, but we'll know in 10 to 15 years for a dollar invested today what the return will be like. So the company and its predecessors have invested a substantial sum of money over the past 15 years, and that has some expected return, and that's that final component. So at the current prices, the stock, I believe, is fairly attractive. I think the expectations are low, and if you look at that chart, you can see the red line intersecting the base case where there's very little, there's no value being assigned to the pipeline and very little credit being given to these other drugs if my assumptions about Botox and medical aesthetics are correct. And that is the key to the thesis. So that's where I'll focus the presentation. So if we continue, Basically, at Silvering Value Partners, I practice a five-step research process. The goal really is to answer two questions. The first is, how predictable is the long-term economic outcome of this business? And then the second question is, what is a reasonable range of intrinsic values? And so step one is company quality assessment. And that really is comprised of the business quality, the management quality, and the balance sheet quality. Makes sense. I think those are common sense things to focus on if you're assessing a company for investment. In Allergan's case, as I mentioned, the kind of the overall sales breakdown you see here is a little bit deceptive. And you can see that Botox accounts for about 20% of revenues, and medical aesthetics, excluding Botox, just under 20 as well. And it seems like these are fairly small pieces of the business, but because of the economic characteristics are so superior to the rest of the business, because of that long tail of cash flow and the growth opportunities there, they account for a much bigger piece of the value than they do of the current sales. In terms of the structural industry analysis for the pharmaceutical industry, I believe the industry is quite attractive. And what makes it attractive is a combination of high barriers to entry. So we talked about, basically, if we were to try to compete from scratch today, it would take us 10 to 15 years to develop a drug. It would take us substantial capital. We would also need to have access to physicians and so forth. You also have, a business that's characterized by competition that's based on the quality of the product, and that quality is usually a combination of efficacy, so side effect profile, and the mode through which the drug is delivered or the dosage, as opposed to the price. And sure, if the two drugs are very similar, then price is important. But to the degree that you have a superior product, you typically get pricing power for it. So I do think this is an attractive business today. For Allergan, the company has a sustainable competitive advantage that's basically a function of three things. The first is the very strong Botox brand that likely creates very inelastic demand that's very similar to luxury goods, and we'll talk about that in a minute. You also have a fairly dominant market share neuromodulators, which is what Botox is, and also medical aesthetics, which leads to a scale advantage in sales and marketing. And then you also have patents protecting these drugs for a number of years, as well as some of the other drugs. So those three things combined, I believe, give the company a meaningful competitive advantage. One thing I like to see in terms of quality, which, quality to me is a function of how predictable are the long-term economics of the business, is what I don't want to see is rapid share change, right? Because if you do see market share changing very rapidly, that means it might be very hard to predict who is going to leapfrog the company and overtake it and cause the company to lose a lot of share. So what you're seeing here on this chart is the global neuromodulator sales, which is the drug class of which Botox is part of, are growing at a healthy clip. And Botox, while it's losing share a little bit, it's doing so despite two new, cheaper competitors having entered in the last 5 years, which to me is a very good result. If you have a company having two competitors who claim to do the same thing as you, only going from low 80s to low 70s in market share over a decade, that's a pretty dominant franchise in my view. You can see that in other parts of the business as well, in fillers, which is the biggest part of the medical aesthetics business, where the company has a high and stable to rising market share. So again, it speaks to the company's predictability of long-term economics. So, zooming into to Botox, I think that it's important to understand who the customers are. And typically, especially on the cosmetic side, they're wealthy. They care about what their peers think. And they identify Botox with the category, similar to how Xerox was synonymous with a photocopy. The other point that is important to highlight is that the tox in Botox stands for toxin. And so a long track record of safety is very important. And, absence of proof of negative side effects for a new launch from a competitor is not quite the same as proof of absence. A useful analog that I would like to point to is Amgen had a drug by the name of Enbrel, which was a complex biologic. And that drug was on the market for quite a number of years. It was pretty good in terms of efficacy and excellent in terms of safety. And then that drug class saw quite a few other drugs enter that demonstrated superior efficacy and similar safety, so you would have thought that Enbrel would be losing a meaningful amount of share. However, doctors really do not like to switch from what's working, and they're also by nature, pardon me, a suspicious bunch. And so the fact that Enbrel had that very long-term track record of safety was enough to allow it to have pricing power and allow for its revenues to grow, even though these other drugs had a somewhat better, efficacy profile. So overall, I think the business is what I would call excellent quality, in my view. And one thing I like to do with quality is to have a quantitative validation. So it's all nice and well if I'm qualitatively analyzing the business as excellent, but where can we see this in the numbers? And typically, what you want to see is a record of high return on capital over a long period of time that supports that qualitative assessment. In this case, the numbers are a little trickier, and the reason is because the current Allergan was put together through a series of acquisitions and divestitures. So, as you probably know, there are two components to returns on capital. One is what is the return on tangible capital? So, how good is this business as a business? And secondarily, what is the return on, management's allocation of capital? So, did the management do a good job of deploying capital? Did it pay too high a price or did it pay a good price for what it acquired in a case like this? So, in this case, there's definitely evidence of a very high return on tangible capital, as well as the legacy Allergan, which is where Botox and the medical aesthetics businesses originated, having very high economic profits and ROIC. However, the current Allergan does not have a very high return on capital. It's about 5%. It's pretty low. And that's a function of the price paid for the legacy Allergan business, as well as some of the recent earlier stages acquisitions that the company management has done that are yet to produce a meaningful return. So I would say we'll get to management assessment in a minute, but from a business quality point of view, there's certainly plenty of evidence that the underlying business is a high return on capital business, which supports my analysis that it's a high quality, excellent company. Excuse me. So if we move on to management quality, it really comes down to two things. One is a track record of A, operating the business, and B, capital allocation. And the second is alignment of incentives with shareholders. So I think that in terms of the track record, it's a bit hard to make any definitive conclusions. I think the management in its current shape has only been added for about 3 years. The key franchises have been doing well and are growing organically at a strong rate, but that's really mostly likely due to prior management, not the current management. The divestiture of the generics business that the company did to Teva looks like a smart capital allocation decision. However, the purchase of Allergan so far is clearly not earning its cost of capital, and the more recent deals are too recent to really fully assess. So I would say there's nothing that says that the track record is in any way above average. In terms of alignment, I would say alignment is above average. I always like to see direct share ownership, and in this case, the CEO owns about $30 million in shares, which, but he's a relatively young guy. I think this is the substantial majority of his net worth. You also have the ex-CEO of Actavis, which is one of the predecessor companies, and who's on the board, also owning $60 million in the shares. So you have fairly aligned management in terms of direct ownership. The you know when you go if you go to the proxy, you certainly have a compensation system that's okay. You have revenue and EPS goals. You have performance shares based on the total stock return relative to the industry and R&D outcomes, but it could certainly be better. And by that, I mean if we had economic profits or return capital as part of the compensation. So overall, I would say management is somewhat above average, with an average or hard to indistinguishable track record and above average alignment. Finally, balance sheet quality. What we're looking for here is the ability to withstand temporary adversity without needing to raise capital and appropriate leverage relative to profitability that doesn't really, require us to give up our free cash flow to reduce debt. I would say the business is appropriately levered. It's about 3.5x debt to EBITDA. Its interest coverage is about 7x, and its maturities are well distributed over time. So I would, describe this as a, appropriate balance sheet structure for a company that's not very cyclical and is fairly resilient in terms of its cash flow. So I think it's appropriate to call it average. So step two focuses on economic analysis of economic variables. And the question is, what are a small handful of things that we'd like to know about the business 10 years from now that will really tell us, you know, that its economic future? In this case, you know, I think it's Botox sales growth, it's medical aesthetics as sales growth, and it's how successful will the pipeline be. So starting with Botox, you basically have a market that's large, is distributed between, you know, cosmetic uses as well as therapeutic uses, and has grown at a rapid clip over the long term. And there are reasons to believe, due to its low penetration and new indications, that's going to continue to grow at a rapid clip. Here you can see, you know, the history for the therapeutic growth for the of the class, and in that line on the bottom below the chart, you can see the new indications which expanded the market and allowed for additional growth. You can also see on this slide the cosmetic use for this class, and you can see that there has been substantial entry into this class, which has, you know, certainly not slowed anything down. If anything, it's been expanding the market. So, you know, it's important when talking about Botox, it's important to talk about the threats, because part of the kind of negative view in the company, which is always important to understand, is that Botox is under attack. It's not going to be nearly as successful as it has been, and therefore it's not as valuable as a franchise. And there are three threats. The first threat is a biosimilar version of Botox. The second threat is a longer acting toxin from a company called Revance. And the third threat is a new class of drugs called CGRPs that address one of the therapeutic indications for which Botox is used, which is chronic migraine. So addressing them in turn, I think the biosimilar Botox is the least likely to be impactful. I think given the superior track record of safety, the fact that it's a complicated toxin, and where, you know, safety is very important, and if you get something just slightly off, you can have serious medical consequences, and just a very strong brand, which will certainly protect it in the cosmetic uses, I'm not that worried about the eventual biosimilar Botox taking very large market share, but it'll certainly take something, although I expect it to be small. I think the longer acting toxin is a reasonable threat. I think that there is survey evidence from doctors that rather than the 3 month duration, which Botox has 6 month duration would be valuable to them. I do think that there are substantial defenses that, you know, the entrant would have to overcome between the brand equity as well as the bundling and the pricing scheme that Allergan employs to reimburse physicians, which would make a single product entrant a little bit, it'll create some challenges for them in the market. And thirdly, CGRPs definitely will take some market share in migraine. You know, the first one, which is a drug by Amgen, just got approved. Allergan has its own CGRPs in the pipeline. They're expected to launch in a couple of years. But for the time being, there will be some doctors who previously used Botox for this indication that will now switch. However, I think the impact is going to be limited for reasons I'll show in a second. So I think you can see from this chart that basically duration is an important consideration for Botox, as I mentioned. You can see in survey data that you know, physicians are interested in switching, you know, potentially to a longer acting toxin, but I think there's also a difference in what people say in the survey and what they do when they're real patients and when their economic, you know, well-being is to some degree on the line. So I think this is important data to consider, but I don't think the level to which these surveys indicate is representative of the eventual share that the new longer acting toxin is likely to take. This is a recent survey by JP Morgan about how doctors plan to use or not use the new CGRP class. And, you know, you can see that a substantial minority are going to decrease their use of Botox. So it's something that's important to consider. And so, you know, without kind of getting too granular, what I've done is, you know, you know, we have, you know, kind of two dimensions here. We have the market growth, which is likely to be meaningfully above average because of the low penetration and the recently approved indications. and you have the share change that's likely to happen due to this these competitive threats. And obviously, you can't have a supreme confidence in any one point, but you can certainly think about range. And I think for me, what's the most likely is we're going to have, maybe a 25% share loss over a 10-year period to these threats. And that's going to be offset by low double-digit, 10% plus organic growth rate for the market. So my range of outcomes for Botox is anywhere from 3 to 12% with a base case of 8%. Obviously, there's not trying to imply any false precision there, but so I would focus more on the range than the base case point estimate. The medical aesthetics business, which is anchored by the filler franchise, is also has been a high growth business. It's been growing 8% organically. The company has recently acquired several important new drugs in this portfolio. So if anything, this portfolio is now younger in its maturity curve than it has been 5 years ago. And so I believe that this business is also capable of high single-digit growth in the base case with a range anywhere from 2 to 12%. So I think I mentioned my R&D process in the past, but what I try to not do is I don't try to estimate drug by drug, addressable market, probability of success, market share, and so forth. And it's not because that's a bad way of doing it, but I don't do it that way for two reasons. One is I think it ignores the early stage pipeline, and it creates this bias that I think other market participants frequently have of focusing only on what's visible in the late stage pipeline, because it's very hard to know about something that's in phase, 2A or something like that. But nonetheless, on average, it's likely to have some expected value. And that's important to capture. And secondly, I don't think I really have an edge on drug by drug, probabilities of, success and so forth. I can certainly use the base rate probabilities from FDA approvals, but I'm not sure that that's that insightful. So instead, what I do is I take an expected value approach where I look at the company's overall track record of R&D productivity. I bring it close towards the industry. So kind of assuming that some of it was luck, some of it was skill. So I give partial weight to the industry track record, partial weight to the company's track record. And the base case, I basically come up with an expected value return R&D that determines my pipeline peak sales in a number of years. Whereas in the worst case, I assume that there is no pipeline value at all. So if you look at how this works in this case, you can see that, following these steps and assuming, in this case, I'm just using the industry average productivity because the current management hasn't really been in charge long enough to come up with a meaningful track record under their guidance. So just using the industry as a full 100% weight yields pipeline peak sales 5 years out of about $3.5 billion. And I think that's one of the things where it helps me guard against behavioral biases, because I think part of the way these type of stocks get mispriced by the market is this fear and greed cycle that takes a recent data point or two about the pipeline and causes the market participants to be the very, excited about the pipeline because of that one or two data points, or to get very pessimistic about the pipelines. And therefore, the implied value of the pipeline frequently moves around very rapidly. Whereas the reality is, a lot of these companies, including Allergan, have many pipeline products. There's very rarely just one thing that's going to make or break the pipeline. And really having this recency bias of extrapolating a recent trial or two and assuming it applies to the whole pipeline in terms of the quality of the rest of the programs, I think it's a misguided way of thinking about the value of the pipeline. So what I do gives up precision, but I think it gets me to approximately right rather than precisely wrong. So step three is financial modeling, where I model the three scenarios from worst to best, with base being the outcome that I think is the most likely. In this case, it just really follows from the prior work that we talked about. You end up with a situation, and I'll show you this visually, where You can see that I know there's a lot going on in terms of colors, but the bottom two parts of these bar charts, this is Botox and medical aesthetics. And you can see if we were to take away all the other two components, that would be more of a secular growing kind of luxury good, you know, think Louis Vuitton handbags or whatever your favorite luxury good might be. While as the green bar and the purple bars are much more limited in duration, and you know, they go up and down and eventually they mostly go away. And that's the other drugs where the patents expire and it's the pipeline. So I think that there's this nonlinearity where you have these businesses which I believe have embedded, you know, strong competitive advantages and strong pricing power. And they're being partially obscured by some of these other drugs which have much less favorable economic characteristics. So, you know, this naturally flows into free cash flow, which, you know, as equity investors, what we ultimately care about. And there's two ways of looking at the free cash flow. So for companies that have shown evidence that they're going to, you know, keep a certain, you know, roughly constant leverage throughout, I take into account how much capital will be used or produced by changes in debt. So that's the red bars. And the blue bars are just your normal free cash flow, so cash flow from operations minus capex. So you can see that this business is, you know, highly free cash flow generative, and in this case, debt has a little bit of an impact, you know, slightly negative in the beginning because the company intends to delever slightly from 3.5 times to under 3 times. That's what that reflects. I'm not gonna test your eyesight here with the model, but this is basically how all these assumptions flow together to create the model. I'm happy to take any questions on this. And then the valuation, you know, there's, you know, it's not a difficult exercise in once the financial modeling has been complete, because ultimately we're just asking what is the stream of cash flows worth today. I tend to use a consistent discount rate of 10% discount rate to equity. The idea being is that it should really reflect your opportunity cost. And while some have argued that maybe in today's environment, a lower rate is more realistic, I don't want to lower the bar because having done this for 17 years plus, I've just observed that environments can change rather rapidly. And as an absolute value investor, I'm just not going to lower my bar just because the current, you know, interest rate environment is lower than history or something like that. I do believe that for a strategy that's, you know, small and, you know, capacity constrained, there will be opportunities to invest at high rates of return in the not too distant future. So the range of values here is fairly attractive. You know, the downside to worst case is less than 25%, and that's a pretty severe worst case. You can think of it as a 1.5 to 2 standard deviation scenario. And the base case allows us plenty of upside or the expected return. You know, there, I always like to use some sanity checks. You know, one of the knocks against using DCF models is that essentially they can tell you anything you want them to tell you. And that's true. And my counter argument is frequently as well, you know, if you don't know how to use a hammer, you can really hit your finger instead of hitting the nail when you use it. But that shouldn't tell you that you should be using a screwdriver to hammer in a nail. It should really just tell you that you should learn how to use the hammer to hit the nail and not your finger. So one of the ways in which, you know, I do that is to have sanity checks. One of them is, for instance, you know, implied price to normalized earnings, and in this case it's just under 15 times for a business who, you know, a big portion of which is essentially a long duration growing cash flows, you know, with strong quality of characteristics. So to me that makes sense. Another way is the IRR, and the IRR tells you, well, if I bought this business, held it forever, never sold it, and just got exactly the free cash flow that in each scenario, what would be my internal rate of return? And so in my base case, it's north of 14%. In my worst case, it's just over 7%. So these numbers, you know, make sense to me, meaning that if the range of IRRs is 7 to 19, that seems to be pretty attractive range to invest. So this is the chart I talked about, you know, where you can see the price is fairly undemanding as long as we are roughly right on Botox and medical aesthetics, which is again the key to the thesis. And the pipeline is really going to determine the magnitude of the upside as opposed to provide us with, our base return, if you would. I always like to do sensitivity analysis. Certainly one scenario can happen is, let's say, the new class of drugs and for migraine, CGRPs, are much more successful, and so Botox is no longer used for migraine. So that would lower the base case by $30. Another is, let's say I'm wrong and there's no more growth in medical aesthetics. That's $50. The good news about all these sensitivity analysis, even though they're fairly meaningful deviations from my base case expectations, in all of these scenarios, the stock is still undervalued, just by less than we expect. And that's, I think, part of the point of margin of safety, is you want, to allow for a number of things to go differently than the way you expect, and still not lose money and maybe make some money if you're wrong. Finally, behavioral checklist. I always like to, just go through a few common questions. Have recent developments, positive and negatives, colored my analysis of the prospects of the companies proportionally to their long-term significance. If the markets were closed, would I be comfortable owning the security for 5 years or more? Do I have emotions, towards this investment in either direction? And I think in this case, it's a pretty clean story from a logic point of view. It's really my, structural analysis of Botox and medical aesthetics. I think it's misunderstood, and people are treating them much more like drugs. And if these were products in another industry, but with the same economic characteristics, this would not, in my view, be perceived the way it is. So I think I have a fairly logical approach to this. I'm not too concerned about biases, although by their very nature, I'm always concerned because one of the most common biases is overconfidence. So I never want to assume that I'm immune to these, because I'm sure we all have them to some degree. In terms of the portfolio construction, just to wrap up, typically for an excellent business, I demand the stock be no more than 75% of the base case value estimate. In this case, this Allergan stock clearly qualifies. But in terms of position sizing, for something to be more than a small position, for me, small is 5%, medium is 10%, large is 15% of cost. For something to be a medium position, I need the downside to worst case to be limited. And for something to be a large position, I need that plus the business quality to be at least above average. And that makes sense because in a concentrated portfolio, you really don't want to have, average businesses with, maybe weak balance sheets that are maybe cheap become really large position size, because I think that's one way that can lead to permanent capital impairment if you're wrong. So in this case, I initially made Allergan a small position, which would be 5% at a cost of $180 in November of last year, when it fell below my 75% of base case value mark. And very recently, I made it a medium-sized 10% position when the stock fell below $155 a share, which put it below 65% of my base case. And so these guidelines is one of the ways that I try to guard against behavioral biases. Some people might find them too overly precise or overly mechanical, and I recognize there's that aspect. But I also think that the flip side, which is kind of shooting from the hip and using your feel or just, guessing, it's prone to behavioral mistakes. And I'd rather be very disciplined, very process oriented in terms of how I construct the portfolio, rather than kind of ad lib it too much. So that concludes kind of what I wanted to say. You can certainly follow up. My email is on the screen, is gary@silveringvaluepartners.com. As is silveringvaluepartners.com is the main website, and I also write monthly articles at behavioralvalueinvestor.com. So John, happy to take any questions you might have.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for articulating your investment thesis so comprehensively. And by the way, thanks also for mentioning your website, which I would highly recommend. The articles are truly terrific. Perhaps in terms of capital allocation, Is there anything that you might prioritize differently than the management team is doing right now?
It's a good question, and thank you for the kind words, John. I think, the late, management just has gone through a portfolio review, and the question that they were trying to ask is, should they try to, maybe separate the business in some major way? And I think, so the conclusion that came that came out of it is that they were going to try to sell two smaller businesses, women's health and one other one, that cumulatively combined, they're maybe 10% of the value. So they're not going to move the needle. There'll be small divestitures, and that's fine. I think some have pushed for bigger splits. So one theory was, why don't we, kind of highlight the value of these higher growth, higher quality franchises by having them be standalone businesses? And I think management provided a good answer, because something like Botox spans cosmetic use, which is much more of a, just traditional luxury good, and therapeutic use, where you need a dedicated sales force. So there would be substantial deleverage on that specialized sales force if they were going to just, carve up the company just to try to get a higher multiple or something like that. So I think I am with them as far as, basically running the business for maximum long-term economic value. The other question, I think there's been several reports of recent activist activity, is, are they doing that? Do they need, a fresh perspective? I mean, are they executing well? I think it's a tougher question to answer. I think that there is not enough evidence to say that they're screwing up. I also don't think that there is evidence to say that they're doing really well. I think some of that will manifest itself over the next several years. Would I mind if, I think, one of the rumored individuals was bringing back the legacy Allergan CEO, who's created a lot of value, as chairman of the board? I mean, I don't think it's a terrible idea, but I think that it really comes down to, if we really don't trust these people to allocate capital for us, we need a wholesale management change, not just a board change. So I think, to answer your question, I would rather they kind of held off on M&A right now, unless something is particularly compelling, especially since they recently have done a number of early stage deals, and really just try to execute on the pipeline, execute on growing the market for Botox, which, where there's a large opportunity, strengthening their brands, and really just return capital to shareholders. And from my perspective, I would like to see, as soon as the debt situation is within their comfort zone, I would like to see a large share buyback if the stock price is anywhere close to this level, because that's one of the ways they can create value. And by the way, they have shown us that they are capable of shrinking. For instance, they sold the generic business to Teva at what looks like a very attractive price from the seller's point of view. So they're clearly not just empire builders where they're just trying to grow for growth's sake. And I think their direct share ownership highlights that. So I think my view would be, enough early stage acquisitions. Let's just maximize the value of what we have, especially since we don't really have a full track record yet that tells us we want to give the management full kind of freedom to just allocate all our free cash flow into long duration assets.
For somebody who is interested and would like to track this idea over time, what might be some data points to look at to either validate or challenge your thesis?
So I think, you have Botox growth, which is one of the key indicators, and the growth there has been low teens. I certainly, I'm not expecting that to sustain itself. I would expect something more in the high single digits over the next 10 years. So Revance is supposed to launch its long-acting toxin in 2020, I believe, and so that the degree to which that gains market share will be very important to watch, and if that really takes Botox from a, 10% plus trajectory to, decline or something like that, that would be really troubling. Another, data point is, you have that launch of the first CGRP drug by Amgen. So to the degree that takes much more share in migraine and reduces Botox use there, again, that would be a counterthesis data point. In terms of medical aesthetics, again, you have these businesses that have more of a consumer good type of profile and very low market penetration. You want to see management continue to build those brands and grow penetration. So if all of a sudden we hit a wall, that would tell me maybe I was wrong in terms of thinking how large the market opportunity was and how much there was still to go. So I think those are some things. I mean, in terms of the pipeline, the management has identified five or six key products that they're hoping to launch. So if I don't expect 100% success rate, but if three or four of those completely fail for some reason, that would reduce my value. Although, given where the stock is, it would still leave the stock undervalued. So those are the things I'm watching, and the things I'm not watching, which unfortunately, or well, fortunately, I think the market is part of the reason the stock sold off so much is one of its lar currently large drugs, called Restasis, basically, to keep things simple, lost patent exclusivity earlier than the market thought. While it's a big earnings hit in the short term, I mean, the drug was supposed to have two or three more years of a patent life, and now it won't. The net present value impact of that is very small because, it was a very small part of the net present value calculation. However, in the short term, the hit to earnings is larger. So I think people are focusing on that as measure of progress, and that's literally why the stock went from 250 to 150 in a span of 6 months. And I think that's really not what is going to determine the economic future of this business. I really think it's about Botox, medical aesthetics, and the pipeline.
Terrific, Gary. Well, I'll leave it there, and I would just encourage listeners and members to feel free to follow up with their own thoughts and questions. Your email is showing here on the screen. Thank you once again for being with us and taking the time to share your insights.
Great. Well, thank you, John. Really appreciate you having me.
Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.